Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A new report from the U.S. government on the terrorist threat facing the nation paints a decidedly mixed picture. It's sort of a good news, bad news assessment, a little something for everyone depending upon your point of view or your need for political cover, as the case may be. Portions of the new National Intelligence Estimate were declassified and released today. The NIE is a summary of terrorist threat reports from 16 different spy agencies. First, the good news in the war on terror. The report concludes that worldwide counterterrorism efforts since 9/11 have successfully weakened and constrained the ability of al-Qaeda to attack the U.S. Now the bad news. Al-Qaeda has a new base in Pakistan and will probably try to take advantage of its new contacts and capabilities in Iraq to mount an attack on U.S. soil. As a result, reads the report, the U.S. is currently in a heightened threat environment. Earlier today, Fran Townsend, the president's advisor for Homeland Security, highlighted some of the threats.
Al-Qaeda will continue to attempt visually dramatic mass casualty attacks in the homeland, and they will continue to acquire and employ chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear materials, and will not hesitate to use them.
That's Fran Townsend, the president's advisor for Homeland Security, speaking earlier today in Washington. Joining us now to talk about the National Intelligence Estimate is Tim Starks of Congressional Quarterly. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
I guess one of the more striking points in this report is how al-Qaeda has been able to reorganize itself in the tribal areas of Pakistan. What does the report say about this?
Well, what it says is that that safe haven area has gotten stronger. In Pakistan, there's been a real conflict between moderates and extremists that in some ways is getting worse. And while it's been getting worse, the extremists have been getting bolder, and that's caused more problems for Pakistan in trying to crack down on this, which, you know, meaning the United States, have criticized Pakistan's willingness to crack down on that safe haven. The other issue is that the al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is the affiliate,
right,
has actually helped strengthen the broader al-Qaeda network, the traditional leadership of al-Qaeda, what you think of with the Osama bin Ladens. So by being affiliated with that movement, al-Qaeda has gotten stronger.
Has gotten stronger because they might be able to capitalize on those resources in Iraq since the U.S. invasion, essentially.
Precisely. That Al-Qaeda in Iraq has actually helped al-Qaeda raise more money and energized, in the words of the key judgments of this intelligence estimate, energized the broader Sunni extremist community. So it's actually helped them recruit, it's helped them indoctrinate, it's helped them in a number of ways.
Now, a frequent criticism, of course, of the administration is that the president made a mistake in focusing on Iraq when the report shows that Pakistan is the place where al-Qaeda is regrouping. Has the administration responded to that criticism since the release of this report?
Well, the administration's line has been and remains today that Iraq is the central focus of the war on terrorism. But there's been somewhat of a deafening response from Democrats in particular, saying, wait, the report says, your own intelligence agencies say, that from Pakistan, from that Pakistan-Afghanistan region is where al-Qaeda is. So they've had the same response, but Democrats are pushing back really hard and saying, no, this is not an Iraq issue. This is Afghanistan, and this once again proves that we should have been focusing all our energies on the ultimate leadership of al-Qaeda.
This year's National Intelligence Estimate says that al-Qaeda leadership is going strong, getting stronger. Just last year, the same report said that the terrorist group's leadership was in disarray. What's happened in a year to bring about this change?
Well, I think it goes back to that increasingly strong safe haven in Pakistan, and the increased popularity, strange though it may sound, of the war the war in Iraq with extremists. This war seems to be going well for them in some ways right now, and as a result, that has strengthened al-Qaeda in Iraq and then strengthened al-Qaeda overall.
Tim, we have about 10 seconds left. Does the report point to any specific evidence that an attack on the U.S. is being planned?
It does not, but it does warn strongly about the al-Qaeda attempts to employ chemical, biological, nuclear weapons.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much for joining us and helping us out today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Tim Stark of Congressional Quarterly talking to us about the just-released National Intelligence Estimate. Turning now to the war in Iraq and to the latest casualty report, which comes from The Nation magazine. An investigation by the magazine highlights what it calls a pattern of brutal treatment of Iraqi civilians by some U.S. soldiers and Marines. The Nation interviewed 50 combat veterans, many of whom participated in or witnessed the killings and abuse of innocent Iraqi civilians, including children. The article alleges a combination of stress, panic, and recklessness on the part of U.S. forces has led to the deaths of perhaps thousands of innocent civilians, abuses that in most cases were not investigated by military authorities. Chris Hedges, a veteran war correspondent, co-authored the article and joins us from New York City. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by John Bruins, a former Army sergeant and an Iraq War veteran who is quoted in the report. He now works for the group Americans Against Escalation in Iraq, and he joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you, John Bruins.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, let's start with you. We have heard disturbing stories over the past 2 years about misconduct and alleged misconduct by U.S. forces. There was Abu Ghraib, of course, court hearings this week surrounding a massacre in Haditha, among a handful of other well-publicized cases. What does your report add to the record?
Well, that rather than chronicle isolated cases, we're talking about patterns of abuse, that the way the war is now configured and the way it is being fought is one that has become very dangerous to innocent Iraqi civilians. The occupation forces are so beleaguered, so outgunned, the danger is catastrophic in terms of its consequences and frequency, that basically everything now outside the perimeter of these fortified compounds becomes a target, whether these people are armed or not.
Mm. You focus on several areas and several types of combat operations, one in particular how U.S. soldiers and Marines conduct raids of private homes as they search for weapons and insurgents. What do the veterans say?
These are, you know, have happened tens of thousands of times. They rarely find anything of consequence. And we tried to focus, rather than write broadly about the war, on sort of snapshots of the war, convoys, raids, detentions, laying down suppressing fire after IEDs go off, to show how cheap life has become for Iraqi civilians.
Well, I want to talk about some specific cases to get an idea of what you heard, but let me go over to John Bruins. You took part in many of these raids. Tell us how they worked.
Well, what would normally happen would be, let's say one day a roadside bomb goes off, and the next day there's an RPG attack, and the day after there's, you know, some sporadic gunfire on U.S. troops. And it's all happening in the same sector. So a battalion commander will just basically, you know, give an order to his battalion. Hey, we're going to go in there tonight into the sector, and we're going to surround it and quarantine it. We're not going to let anybody in or out. And we are going to enter the homes of the Iraqi people that live in this community. And what we're looking for are weapons, anti-U.S. propaganda, any intelligence at all that would lead to the insurgency, bomb-making material, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so the U.S. soldiers go in there with the mentality as if they are going after the enemy. So, you know, you want to do it in the middle of the night. You want to catch them off guard. And, you know, you kick in the front door and you run up the front stairs and you grab the man of the house and you get him out of bed. And if his wife is lying next to him, I mean, it's July, it's August, it's hot. She may be in loose night garments. She may become exposed. It's very humiliating for her. It's very humiliating for her husband. And you'll take this woman, and if there's kids in the house, you will get the kids and the wife, and you'll place them in a room, and you'll put a guard on the door, and you'll get the man of the house, and we would interrogate the man through the interpreters. And we would, you know, after the interrogation or during the interrogation, we would, you know, open up his closets, and whatever was in his closets, we would take everything out and dump them on the floor. If there's any furniture, we would turn it upside down. And in the Nation article, I said that I probably participated in close to 1,000 raids. And I want to make sure I clarify that. You know, if you go on 3 raids a week and each night you do 30 homes, I mean, that's close to, you know, 90 to 100 homes per week. So that's where that figure comes from. Mm-hmm. And when these raids are happening, I really believe that caused a lot of resentment among the Iraqi people. and cause them to join a resistance movement against the United States.
A lot of what is in this report really rises to the level of serious abuse, in some cases murder, in some cases war crime. In those 1,000 raids that you took part in or witnessed, did you see anything that rose to that level?
No. It's how we were operating in the homes. We were not treating the Iraqi people with respect.
Chris, let me come back to you. As I read through the article, there are incidents that you described that other veterans have described that go way above the kind of level of violence that John Bruins was just describing. As uncomfortable as that is, you know, rousting people out of bed and all that, there's worse stuff that's going on there. And I'm thinking, for instance, of the way the convoys operate sometimes. And there was some really striking and disturbing testimony that you heard about the convoys.
The convoys have really become freight trains of death. They race through Iraqi towns, villages, and cities, you know, jumping the meridian, driving the wrong side down the street, often at 50, 60 miles an hour. They don't stop if they run over civilians. They crash into Iraqi vehicles to push them out of the way. And when there is a threat of investigation, many veterans told us that they kept AK-47s that they would lay down next to the bodies, or sometimes shovels to indicate that the person was digging a hole to plant an IED, to label these innocents as combatants. So I think what we wanted to do by interviewing extensively with these veterans such as John is give people an idea of what's happening on the ground. And I think it's a picture that most Americans up to this point have not seen.
This is sometimes referred to euphemistically as collateral damage. It's a dangerous environment. The enemy adapts quickly. Soldiers have to do what they have to do to protect themselves and carry out a mission. But you feel that this clearly goes beyond sort of acceptable military conduct.
Well, it's self-defeating. That's the point, and I think that's the point that John was making when he was talking about the raids. We don't want to minimize the danger. The danger is real. You know, I think what we're saying is the situation has become so extreme, and the response has become so extreme that in fact it is only making our own presence in Iraq more untenable and more dangerous.
We're speaking with Chris Hedges, a veteran war correspondent and co-author of The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness, which appears in the current edition of The Nation. We're also joined by John Bruins, a former Army sergeant and an Iraq War veteran who was quoted in that article. He now works for the group Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. They'll be back with us in just a moment. And coming up later in the show, the increasing concern over the safety of the food and drugs flowing between China and the U.S. Stay with us here and now. Brooks, it's here and now. We're discussing the stories of 50 Iraq war veterans as reported by The Nation magazine. With us is John Bruins, one of the veterans featured in an article entitled The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness. The veterans tell stories of house raids, checkpoints, and speeding U.S. military convoys that sometimes kill Iraqi civilians, deaths that are not investigated by the U.S. military, according to this article. The article lays the blame not only on individual soldiers, but on stress, a lack of training, and on the way the occupation was planned and the way it's being carried out. The article was co-written by veteran war correspondent Chris Hedges, who also joins us. And Chris, you say you wanted to give readers a picture of what's happening on the ground in Iraq. What response have you had from the Pentagon? I know you made an effort in the course of doing this reporting to reach out to them and get a response to some of these allegations. What did you hear?
Well, we worked for several weeks. We sent them very detailed questions, essentially covering every allegation that was made in the article, and asked them to respond. And they didn't want to do that. They said that these would require them to talk about operations, and that was something that they did not to do publicly. You know, they would not address the detailed descriptions of abuse that made up this 15,000-word piece, which were consistent with dozens of interviews that were carried out, and they just didn't want to go there.
Chris Hedges, let me ask you about some criticism of your report that I'm sure you're familiar with. Paul Rykoff, who's executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and who I understand cooperated with the reporting that you did, he took issue with the reporting on a couple of fronts. First of all, he's concerned that you're putting a spotlight on a few cases of alleged abuse by soldiers and Marines, and therefore you're ignoring the responsibility of the Bush administration and politicians who sent the troops there to begin with. What's your response to that?
No, I think he needs to reread the article. We were very clear that, and nor did we in any way try and finger individuals in this article. It was clear, and that's why we had the critical mass that we did, that this is the result of mismanagement, a mismanaged war policy.
He also suggested that your reporting was a little sensationalist and somewhat unethical because he claims the nation told the veterans they would be interviewed about their service in general, not about civilian casualties.
That's not true.
That's not true. Okay.
No, and we printed a response to his letter. It's up on, I believe it's up on the Nation website, where we actually quoted from the email that we sent to him that said that our focus was the treatment of Iraqi civilians. We were very, very clear from the beginning about what we were doing.
I'm sorry. Can I insert here?
Please. Go ahead, John Bruhn.
I would like to say that just for one, I'm not a pacifist. I'm not anti-war. I viewed 9/11 as my generation's Pearl Harbor. I re-enlisted in the military after 9/11 to fight the real war on terror in Afghanistan. And I just, having said that, I just think that this is a crucial story. And, you know, Mr. Hedges, he interviewed numerous veterans, and these are their stories, and I just think it's imperative that people listen to them.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in today. Chris Hedges is co-author of the article, The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness, which appears in the current edition of The Nation. And John Bruhns is a former Army sergeant and an Iraq war veteran. He now works for the group Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. Thank you both for coming in today. I'm very grateful.
Thanks. Thank you.
We now turn to Paul Rykoff, executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, who, as we just mentioned, has some concerns about this report. And Paul, I saw your letter to the editor in the New York Times. It seems as though you're most concerned that this article focuses on alleged abuses by U.S. service members rather than on the politicians and the policies that put U.S. troops in this situation without a clear plan. Is that your biggest objection?
No, it's really not. My biggest objection is the tactics, and I would argue unethical way this story was put together.
How so? Why unethical?
Yeah, well, I think we need to start by understanding that this is slanted, biased, and politically motivated journalism. I would call it Fox-style journalism, but from the left. The Nation is an anti-war magazine. The editors intro this piece by basically denouncing the war and saying the problem is not a few bad apples, but the occupation itself. It needs to end. And Chris Hedges was on your program, but I spoke to over a dozen of the veterans interviewed, and not one of them ever spoke to Mr. Hedges. Most of them spoke to a woman named Layla Al-Aryan.
That was the co-author of the article.
Right. Now, she is not only an amateur reporter, but she's also previously been an advocate for her father, who pled guilty to terrorism charges in 2005. So there is clearly an underlying motive here on the part of both the magazine and the reporters to use these troops involved in this story and use the story itself for other politically motivated and slanted end states. So
and what would be that? What would be that purpose? What would be the political motivation?
Well, cherry picking stories from 50 veterans about killing civilians makes a wonderful criticism of the war. It doesn't really get into the core issues of policy, of rules of engagement, and the larger problems, which do need to be addressed. Now, mind you, I understand that, and we don't excuse criminal behavior, and I think there's definitely a story here to be had talking about the role of civilian casualties in the battlefield and how troops have been involved there. We all understand that. But this is what really amounts to a hit job. Most of the troops that I spoke to did not know they were involved in a story about civilian casualties. One of our veterans, Patrick Campbell, spoke to Ms. Al-Aryan for 15 hours about his entire service in Iraq, only to have one story of civilian casualties cherry-picked. So many of the veterans involved in this piece feel betrayed. The Nation got that comprehensive amount of information because they misled many of the veterans about the focus of the piece.
I want to throw this one idea out for sort of an appeal for common ground, possibly. Do you accept the broad part of the broad thesis, and that is, in a poorly managed war, in a difficult and demanding urban environment, soldiers who are perhaps not given adequate cultural and linguistic training, who are under enormous stress, can in some cases be pushed into actions that result in unfortunate and perhaps unnecessary civilian casualties?
Sure.
That's what I took away from the article.
That's entirely reasonable. It is worthy of discussion. But I think when we use a piece as a fulcrum for that discussion, we need to think about its source. We probably wouldn't be on NPR right now talking about a piece on Sean Hannity's Fox News channel that discussed this topic. And I think that the Nation really comes from that same area. The Nation is a Fox News from the left. And it really baffles me that they're given the same level of credibility as the Washington Post or the New York Times or some other mainstream paper that is objective.
Okay, Paul, well, I want to thank you for joining us and adding a little more perspective to this. As always, thanks very much.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you.
That's Paul Rykoff, Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. It's Here and Now. Anthony Brooks, It's Here and Now. The Federal Food and Drug Administration's ability to ensure the safety of the U.S. food supply is minimal. That according to congressional investigators who testified before a House subcommittee today. In a moment, we'll talk to a personal injury lawyer who represents victims of contaminated food about the overall safety of the U.S. food supply. But first, today's hearing comes as the U.S. and China spar over tainted food and other products the countries are exporting to each other. It started with tainted pet food and toothpaste from China to the U.S., and just last week, China banned some U.S. chicken and pork from its shores because Chinese officials said the meat was contaminated. Also last week, Chinese authorities executed the man who headed the country's version of the Food and Drug Administration. He wrote a confession, was convicted of accepting gifts and bribes from drug companies, and put to death. David Barboza is a correspondent for the New York Times. He's been following all of this, and he joins us now from Guangzhou in southern China. And David, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Before we talk about this man who was executed last week, I want to know how all these issues are resonating in China right now, going back to the tainted pet food, tainted toothpaste, even tainted Thomas the Tank engines. Is there outrage in China over these problems?
Not at all. I mean, well into my reporting on the pet food recall, most people in China had not even heard about it. And I think even today you'd be hard-pressed to find many people who are really aware. It really has not been widely reported, with maybe the exception of the execution of Zheng Xiaoyu, the former head of their FDA, last week.
I want to ask you about that. Tell us more about Zheng Xiaoyu. This is the man who sort of corresponded to the position of head of the Food and Drug Administration, right?
In fact, he pretty much helped create the Chinese version of the FDA. From 98 until mid-2005, he was the chief overseer of the country's drug safety program.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was promising to modernize China's drug system and to bring in higher standards, he was actually, according to his confession in the government, he was actually accepting lots of bribes and soliciting lots of bribes.
He was accepting, what, $800,000, according to your report, $800,000 in bribes for approving fake drugs, correct?
I don't think they uncovered half of the bribes. I had actually interviewed people who talked to me about a lot of other companies that gave him bribes, and the Chinese government probably didn't find half of it. Hmm. But they got that figure, and that's a pretty big figure in China, and it was enough to say that this guy not only ought to be punished, but he ought to be executed.
Tell us about the problem that the Chinese government is facing with so many fake drugs and illegal drug factories. It seems like this is a huge problem, and I guess this execution was representative of what they're trying to make a statement that they're taking it seriously.
Right. I think one of the things you asked earlier about the reaction in China, and when I talk to educated people in China, they are pretty much surprised at this kind of move for the drug safety chief, because they have had reports in China, although the media is censored, there are occasional reports of, you know, mass poisonings or bad drugs that get out on the market. And we've had some pretty high-profile incidents in recent years, a fake milk powder that actually killed lots of young children and sickened more. And there were other deadly antibiotics that got on the market and killed people. And so this has been happening in China for years. And the FDA that Zheng Xiaoyu was in charge of, they came out with regular reports saying, we closed hundreds of illegal drug factories, and we found crackdown on counterfeiting. And the numbers are astronomical. I mean, if they're really finding 33,000 cases in 1 year of fake products, and they're closing hundreds of factories, and then the very next year they find even more, you've got to wonder about the effectiveness of that. And that has been the case in China for a long time. So the question now is, with this execution, with this very, very big message, and sort of a message that goes also to the international audience that China is now really taking this seriously, is this going to be more than announcements from the government claiming they're cracking down? Are they really going to do something? As I said with Zheng Xiaoyu, he actually gave many speeches where he claimed that his agency was cleaning up the bad guys in the industry and setting higher standards and closing factories, and yet you still had counterfeit drugs in the market. And last year, there was just a huge amount of counterfeit drugs that not only made it into China, but also were being exported to Europe and other countries around the world, including the U.S. So counterfeit drugs are not a problem just for China, although it's been deadly in China. It's been a problem in the rest of the world, in Africa, and in Europe, and in the U.S. The Chinese government is very serious about what's going on now. I was even invited today for the first time. I very rarely get high-level government invitations to visit some food factories with the government, which I've never done. But I think the government now, you can see the level of the concern that every day they have an announcement, they have a new measure, they're showing that they're going to have a recall system, they're going to overhaul food safety, they are doing a lot. Some of the things they're doing are criticizing the U.S. media, but they're also, rolling out everything to show the global community that they care about this. And again, I run back to the question of, what will happen 6 months from now and a year from now? Will they really have done this? Or is it they're just trying to, take pressure off them?
David, what do you make of the reaction by Americans to these to the overall concern about importing food from China?
Well, the reaction that I've seen, and I've been on several talk shows since this erupted, is pretty strong from America and also from Europe. I get lots of calls and emails from Europe, pretty anti-China. In China, you can feel that. You can sense, at least in the government, that there is some, really strong reaction from consumers. And they're kind of blaming China for sending really bad stuff. But there's also another side of this story. In some of my reporting, I've discovered that some of the American companies that are importing are actually not doing their due diligence. They're not checking out what they're importing from China in a close way, and they're probably not taking the responsibility. I mean, behind every product that's coming in from China, you've got an American company or entrepreneur who's bringing it in. In the pet food case and in the toothpaste case, you've got people on the other side in Europe or in the U.S. or South Africa who are importing. And so those companies are going to also have to think through, what are they importing? What are the standards? Have they checked out the company? Have they tested the products? There's a lot of sides to this issue, and that's one side that really hasn't been looked at very much.
Well, David, thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
That's David Barboza, correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Guangzhou, China. Just a reminder, you can hear our program anytime on our website, here-now.org. That's where you can find past programs and where you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. Coming up later in the show, jazz bassist Ron Carter's musical tribute to Miles Davis. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. So, with so much concern about food imports from China, what about the overall safety of the U.S. food supply? William Marler is the managing partner of the law firm Marler Clark, based in Seattle, and he specializes in litigation involving food poisoning. I asked him to assess the food supply here.
U.S. corporations have been doing a marvelous job of poisoning their own customers with their own products for years, and just focusing on China isn't going to solve our food safety problem because our food safety problem is homegrown.
Now, you got your start, I understand, in food litigation back in 1993 when Jack in the Box restaurant had an E. coli outbreak. More than 600 people were sickened. 4 children died. This case had to do with contaminated hamburger meat. How's the meat industry doing since then, in your opinion?
From 1993 to 2002, about 90% of the work that we did in our office was E. coli cases tied to hamburger meat consumption.
Wow.
After 2002, that dropped to nearly zero. There had been a real sea change in how the meat industry approached hamburger, the fact that they were testing for E. coli and finished products, so the product was not even getting on the market contaminated. And we also saw a substantial, a 48% decrease in E. coli cases in the United States. Unfortunately, we've seen a kind of an ominous uptick here in the last 8 to 10 weeks regarding E. coli cases tied to hamburger and other red meat. There was a recent 6 million pound recall. So my hope is that that's, you know, an aberration, and that we're still going to see a downward trend, but I am obviously concerned about that.
Mm. Now, you've got a blog, and we'll link to it on our website. And on that blog, you wrote an op-ed back in 2002 entitled, "Put Me Out of Business, Please." You're not out of business, I take it, which would suggest that this problem is still a problem.
It is. A year ago, I was praising the meat industry for the dramatic change that has occurred, you know, in the last 5 years, in the number of people not getting sick from eating hamburger. And, you know, now, you know, in the last 8 weeks, there are some 50, and right now there's an outbreak in Alabama with nearly 20 more that may be tied to hamburger meat. I mean, I'm concerned that my praise was a little too early. We do have a broken food safety system in America. Having a lawyer in Seattle be the blunt instrument of change isn't necessarily the right way to approach food safety in America.
And speaking of that blunt instrument, I've read you've won $300 million or so from food companies. So you have a lot of experience looking at the supply chain, where the food was grown or raised. Tell me what you've seen about the inspection process and the oversight. Who's watching? Who's monitoring the process?
It's not being monitored as closely as you'd expect. The FDA inspects less than 1% of imports and is very sporadic in inspecting plants. And we haven't really bought into the technology that's available, genetic fingerprinting of food, barcoding of lots. I mean, if you can go online and figure out where your book is in Amazon.com, but you can't figure out where, you know, that pound of hamburger came from. Getting back to your question about put me out of business, I spend about a third of my time now going out to health departments, going out to corporations at conventions and trying to convince them to do exactly that, that it's really a bad idea to poison your customer. And that sounds kind of simple, but what I try to pitch them on is that there's the moral reason.
You know,
and I'll show them pictures of some of these kids who are horribly injured. It's in a business reason. Companies lose millions of dollars to lawyers like me. They lose millions of dollars in sales, and it's not a pleasant thing for a business to go through the scrutiny of one of these outbreaks.
That's William Marler, an attorney from Seattle, who specializes in food poisoning. For more on the story, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Just ahead, jazz man Ron Carter on Here and Now. Anthony Brooks, It's Here and Now. And this, of course, is the unmistakable sound of Miles Davis. After hearing that trumpet, it's difficult to imagine that tune without Miles. Difficult, unless you're bassist Ron Carter. With Herbie Hancock on piano, Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone, and Tony Williams on drums, the group had such a profound influence on jazz music that many jazz enthusiasts continue to make the case that it was the greatest modern jazz band ever. Nearly 40 years after leaving that band, Ron Carter has recorded Dear Miles, his first ever homage to his friend and band leader who died in 1991. And Ron Carter is here with us to talk about the new album. And Ron Carter, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for the invitation and for opening your door wide enough to let me in.
Glad you're here. I read a quote from you in which you said you would have been offended 10 years ago if someone had asked you to do a tribute album like this to Miles. Was it a question, though, of enough time going by and you sort of feeling like this was the time to do something called Dear Miles?
Yeah, I thought that the band had come a long way musically, my current group, and we'd played these songs for a while and kind of discovered some things we could do. And my thought was that Miles' spirit, since he's still here somewhere, would look down on this record and say, gee, I never thought about that. And that's good enough for me.
There are some songs on the CD that Miles Davis stamped with his own sound.
Yes.
For example, Bye Bye Blackbird, My Funny Valentine. You've also included a song that he never recorded, As Time Goes By.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you include that?
Well, he did a Cyndi Lauper tune some time ago. Was it?
Time After Time.
Yeah, you know. And,
beautiful, actually.
Yeah, actually, he made the song valid for me, you know. He gave the song another life, and I think that he would like this version of this old-time black-and-white movie song.
Well, here it is. Let's listen to it for a bit. Ron Carter, Dear Miles is a tribute to a great trumpeter, but it's a CD without a trumpet.
Isn't that wonderful?
it is, but I'm so interested in hearing you talk about that.
Well, you know, one of the problems that bass players face is trying to convince a promoter or a club owner or a record executive that they can, in fact, lead a band and not need a horn player to justify their appearance. The other thing is that when you walk into a jazz room and there's a horn player standing in front of that band, everyone assumes that he or she is a band leader. And since I object to that visual view, I'm not going to hire a horn player just so I don't have to contend with people saying he's a band leader when actually he isn't. It's a tough role for us, and my solution was to band just to have arrangements and the kind of personnel that would make the audience not need to hear a horn player to justify the band's working in this room.
What else should we listen to? Is there something on here that really stands out that you would like, that sort of captures what the CD is about?
I think 595. You know, it's the end of the record. You know, when I make a CD or work in a nightclub, I have a story.
Uh-huh.
And I give some thought to this story that we try to perform every night or on the record. And in this case, the last line of this story is 595.
And this is one of your compositions. Let's listen to that. was astounded when I was reading some of the promo material with the CD that you recorded it in just one morning. This amazes me.
Actually, less.
Less.
A little more than 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
So this was Stephen Scott on piano, Peyton Crossley on drums, and Roger Squitero on drums and percussion. Do you like working that? I mean, why is it important to work that fast together?
My experience has led me to believe that the more takes you do of a selection, the less successful it gets to be musically. I think everyone, after the first two takes, looks at their input to the song, and they're more concerned with their solo or their part, and then they lose view of the big picture, which is how does this band sound? Hmm. And for me to feel that's not going to happen, I tell them we have two chances, and you just had one when you walked in the door. So,
of course, we mentioned this at the top, and it's well known. You were part of a legendary band, and people have always been trying to get you to talk about that experience, about what it was like to play with Miles back in the 60s. You've resisted that, and I'm just wondering if this CD, Dear Miles, invites those conversations.
Well, you know, it isn't that I rejected holding conversations about my relationship with him up to this point, that the questions they asked were so personal.
Hmm.
And I thought that they were looking more to me as a person to confirm or deny the gossip they heard.
I see.
And I wasn't interested in doing that. I mean, I'm not a paid-six kind of reporter, you know. Shh, did he do this? Hey, man, you got the wrong guy, you know. So now that I have this project with my name attached to Dear Miles, I'll have to be a little less selective in how I say no and when I say no to the questions that they ask.
Well, let me ask something.
You're going to try this. Okay.
I'm going to try, but I'm going to try not to do the page six gossip question.
We'll see.
No, it's a very, very general question.
Yeah.
What was that like? How do you like to recall him, I guess, after all these years?
He was a person who was in charge of a laboratory.
Hmm.
And he hired his four assistants, who he gave white coats to, and instructed them to bring any other materials they wanted to bring into this laboratory. But their job was to, whenever they entered this laboratory, to mix some chemicals to make something happen that wouldn't happen without their input. And this laboratory was a bandstand.
Hmm.
And those chemicals are the songs we had. And with Wayne, Herbie, Tony, and myself having the free reign to combine any number of notes and chords and stuff within the time frame of a song or a test tube, it allowed us to make some pretty interesting combinations. And I think one of my views of him is the guy who assembled these four lab assistants in this laboratory called the Jazz Bandstand.
I'm so glad I asked that question.
Now here comes page six.
No. I'm happy there. Okay. I just want to thank you for coming in. Ron
Thanks
Carter,
for the invitation.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
And we'll leave now with the Gil Evans tune Gone as we say goodbye to bassist and jazz legend Ron Carter. Thanks again, Ron. So such a pleasure.
Thank you.
For more on Ron Carter's current tour and his new CD, Dear Miles, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.